It's a Catholic teaching ignored by most Catholics in the West. So is it time for the Vatican to end its ban on artificial birth control? Hello, I'm Andrew West. Welcome to the Religion and Ethics Report. 150 top Catholic scholars challenge the Church to catch up with its own members.
Do praying, worshipping, faithful Catholics accept this teaching? We know that over 90% of Catholic couples in some cultures are practicing artificial methods of contraception.
That's in a moment. Are state governments moving too slowly to set up compensation schemes for victims of institutional sex abuse? And renowned scientist Jane Goodall, who made it her life's work to save the world's chimpanzees, now says we're all threatened by a population explosion. 150 leading Catholic scholars say the Vatican needs to end its ban on artificial contraception, such as condoms. At the United Nations this week, the Reingards Institute for Catholic Research released a statement challenging the 1968 papal document Humanae Vitae, or Of Human Life. It said artificial birth control is against, quote, moral natural law. Now, the Pew Foundation recently found two-thirds of US Catholics don't believe artificial birth control is a sin. The signatories to the Reingard statement include two prominent Australians, retired Catholic Bishop Geoffrey Robinson and former New South Wales Premier Christina Keneally. Another signatory is the British theologian Professor Tina Beattie of Roehampton University.
The Reingard Institute is appealing for a withdrawal of that ban in the case of prophylactic use, for example, the use of condoms to prevent the transmission of HIV/AIDS. And it's calling for an academic study by respected theological scholars and ethicists to look again at the whole question of the use of contraception to prevent conception for a couple who don't want a pregnancy, and for a change in teaching based on that research.
Yes. The main argument, as you say, seems to be that Humanae Vitae was mistaken in its assertion that without contraception, every act of sexual intercourse is open or should be open to pregnancy. You find that mistaken. How?
For a start, we know biologically that's not true, which is why the Church does now accept natural family planning as a way of spacing children. But we know that there are many circumstances when sex serves its purpose of expressing love between a couple, when for reasons of natural biology or ill health or age, it can't possibly be open to conception. And the Church accepts that and says that the sex is still good between married couples for expressing love. Once you've accepted that, you've accepted that it's wrong to say every single act of sex must be open to procreation.
And yes, you also argue that the central text of Christianity, the Bible, finds that there are morally worthy, that's your phrase, morally worthy motives for sexual intercourse that don't involve pregnancy.
There are. I mean, the Bible is full of good sex and bad sex used for all sorts of reasons. And of course, Christianity's central belief hinges on a conception that didn't involve sex at all. So it's a much more complex story than simply reading off the Bible what it does and doesn't teach. The Bible really doesn't teach anything about contraception. And it's an ancient document that has to be interpreted in the light of changing times. What was true for a wilderness community of people, constantly threatened, needing to procreate to survive, is not true for 21st century human beings living in a technological scientific age on a planet that's threatened with our extinction because of overpopulation. Mm.
Can you also explain to us a little-known document, and we don't have to go back 50 years to find it, we only have to go back 10 years to find it. What happened in 2006 with a special Vatican commission that actually did say that the use of condoms for family planning was permissible?
Well, I understand that document has not been widely disseminated. It's also true that before the 1968 Declaration of Humanae Vitae, there was a commission set up to investigate the question, which included married couples. And the majority recommendation of that commission, by a long way, was that the church should respect the conscience of the couple in deciding whether or not to use contraception and what kind of contraception to use. And Paul VI overrode that majority decision in favour of quite a strong minority campaign. Mm-hmm. And I think that remains the position, that probably the vast majority of Catholics, I suspect, would see the sense in quietly leaving behind or explicitly overturning a doctrine that has never gained the acceptance of the faithful people within the church. And that's a litmus test of the truthfulness of a church teaching. Do praying, worshipping, faithful Catholics accept this teaching? We know that over 90% of Catholic couples in some cultures are practicing artificial methods of contraception.
But I think the point is, though, that there is a document that is only 10 years old, that is still in the Vatican, unreleased, that backs up your position that barrier methods of contraception, including condoms and, one assumes, intrauterine devices, are permissible.
Yes, and my understanding from what the very respectable theologians who drafted the document is that this document is there and must be made more publicly available and known. But of course, there are many advisory documents in the Vatican that don't acquire the status of official teaching, because in the end, the official magisterium, including the Pope, have to validate them, if you like, as official before they can be taken as authoritative.
What does it say, Tina, that about 25% of all healthcare in the developing world is delivered by church agencies? What's the special responsibility then on the Catholic Church regarding this prohibition on artificial contraception, the special responsibility of which you're reminding the church?
If you speak to workers in the front line, workers in healthcare facilities in poor situations, where you're right, the Catholic Church is a leading provider of healthcare, there is a gulf between upholding doctrinal absolutes and meeting the pastoral needs of women and girls in sometimes desperate situations, either needing to protect themselves from unwanted pregnancies or needing to deal with pregnancies that are the consequence of rape, and often suffering the consequences then of unsafe or illegal abortion. Those women constitute a large part of the healthcare provision of Catholic healthcare facilities, girls bleeding to death, infected from unsafe abortion. Pope Francis has said he wants a church that smells of the sheep. He wants a church where doctrinal absolutes do not come before the lived realities of human lives in all their messy complexity. And if that is to be the church that can publicly announce its presence, that needs to be taken as a sense of freedom for people who are doing the hands-on work of loving and caring for the poor to speak freely about the needs of the poor, including the needs of poor women around contraception.
I notice that many of the signatories, these leading signatories, are from Catholic universities, but they're emeritus professors. That means they're retired. Is there a fear of retribution among many serving Catholic theologians in Catholic institutions about putting their name to a statement like this?
Yes, and among many priests and bishops. I think if there were not such fear, we would see priests and bishops signing up to a statement like this, and we would have thousands of signatories. But I would just say that there's a very moving story there from Professor Mary McAleese, former president of Ireland, based on her personal experience. Now, I sign this, yes, as a theologian, but I sign it first and foremost as a mother of four adult children, as a woman who's been married for 41 years, and as a grandmother. And I get very angry when I'm told that because I used contraception, my sex life with my husband is somehow rendered bad or illegitimate. I think that's a really toxic thing to say to people. And so I sign documents like this first and foremost as a mother, a wife, and a grandmother, not as a theologian. That comes second.
Professor Tina Beattie, Professor of Catholic Studies at Roehampton University in the United Kingdom. She's one of more than 150 of the world's top theologians, Catholic theologians, who've signed a statement asking the Vatican to review its ban on artificial contraception. Thank you for being with us on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Thank you.
For victims of sexual abuse in the church and state-run homes and schools, the Royal Commission is only one step in overcoming their pain. The Commission has also recommended a national system of compensation. All the churches, or almost all the churches, have agreed. But what about the states? Dr. Wayne Chamley is a spokesman for the survivors advocacy group Broken Rights, and he joins us now. Wayne, welcome.
Good afternoon, Andrew.
Wayne, whose responsibility is it to set up a system of national redress, state or federal governments?
As far as the Royal Commission was concerned, that body saw it as a responsibility of the Commonwealth Government. And its recommendation was that a national scheme be set up under the auspices of the Commonwealth Government, which would provide the support and the backup. And then the institutional and other parties would make their contributions to a board of trustees who would run the scheme.
So who's resisting or dragging the chain in meeting their obligations here?
There's three things going on. The most vigorous resistance is coming from the states, and the states of Western Australia, South Australia and Tasmania argue that they have already run their own redress schemes. This is true, but they were very limited schemes. The anchor of the resistance, I believe, is the New South Wales government. Mm. And what this is about is state governments not facing up to the fact that they created wards of the state. State governments took responsibility for the care of those wards, and now they don't want anything to know about it because they failed them totally.
Surely, though, the bottom line here, Wayne, is that the institutions themselves, be they faith-based or state-based, are responsible for simply finding the money for compensation. And I guess where they don't have the money, then there's a responsibility for the Commonwealth.
Well, it's one of these classic issues of the states vigorously protecting their constitutional responsibilities for matters relating to children, even though quite often they fail children, and not wanting the Commonwealth to get any control. We have to move beyond that. We have to realise this is a large pool of people who, as children, had these terrible experiences, but they were citizens when it was happening. And collectively, the governments have got to work this out.
Yeah, let's put some figures around this. You say a very large number of children. Approximately how many are we talking about, Wayne?
The Royal Commission's working on a figure of about 60,000. I think that's probably too big. I've always been working on a current population of people living of probably between 25 and 30,000 people.
So what is the amount needed for a proper redress system? How much money, as it were, if the government were to follow the Royal Commission's recommendations, how much money would it need, quote, in the bank to ensure justice?
Well, the actuaries worked on a figure of about six, and I think it's been revised down to about 4.8.
But the billion.
contribution, a billion.
Yeah, yes. $1 billion.
But the issue that seems to be the tangling point at the moment, I don't think it's the big issue, but I think it's the one that states are seizing on, is what happens where a past organisation didn't have any insurance, doesn't exist. Who funds those compensations as the funder of last resort? And the recommendation from the Royal Commission was the Commonwealth and the states would share this equally. And that is only, at the outside, $1 billion.
Now, I understand the point that you're making about the responsibilities of state governments that made children, you know, for much of the 20th century, wards of the state. Isn't there a case, though, for making the actual non-government institutions sell property, liquidate assets, and give over as much of that as they can to contribute?
Oh, there is, and they have indicated they will do this. The one that seems to be holding out is the Salvation Army. It's been very non-committal. But there's no argument amongst the major religions, Anglicans, Presbyterians, Catholics. They will contribute whatever is required. So we've got a situation where this compensation scheme can begin very soon, but it's being blocked by the intransigences of the state governments because when they compensate people, they will want to do it through their victims of crime scheme. And those amounts bear nothing in relation to the recommendations of the Royal Commission. We're talking $20,000, $30,000, possibly $40,000. The recommendations of the Royal Commission are minimum $10,000 and a cap of $150,000.
I understand, Wayne, that you suspect there's some resistance from the states because of fears that they may well be open to compensation claims from Indigenous Australians who were taken from their families and placed in institutions during the 20th century.
Well, I think it's a fear of both the states and the Commonwealth government. I suspect that the Commonwealth has got legal advice from Attorneys General and from other policy parts that if it were to compensate people who've been raised in care, it opens a massive gate for compensation schemes to be pursued by Indigenous Australians. The most notable ones will be the Stolen Generation. Mm. We should remember that Prime Minister John Howard said compensation would not be provided, a scandalous response to their situation. And the Commonwealth is sitting on its hands because it's not going to face up to delivering the right response to its citizens.
Dr. Wayne Shamley is a spokesman for Broken Rights, the organisation that represents many victims of institutional sex abuse. Wayne, thank you again for being with us on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Thank you.
And I'm Andrew West here on RN Radio Australia, News Radio and online. His name is Flint, and in a famous photograph, he reaches out with tiny fingers to a woman who's been observing him for many weeks. Now, Flint is a chimpanzee, and the woman is Jane Goodall, the British scientist and environmentalist who in the 1960s changed the way we understand primates. 50 years after that first contact, Jane Goodall is a United Nations messenger of peace. She fears that the wars over religion and resources could wipe out the animals that she's devoted her life to saving. The chimpanzee population, by the way, has fallen 90% in the past 100 years. But humanity is also endangered by the conflicts of our own making. So to mark the UN International Day of Peace, I asked Dame Jane Goodall why the threat to animals is a threat to us all.
The problem is that we're told from various different sources that it's not just the size of the population, but the unsustainable lifestyle of so many of us, and we're actually using up the natural resources at a faster rate than the planet can, you know, restore them. And so if we carry on as usual, and in fact it's getting worse as more countries become more economically successful, which is good in one way, but it's having this heavy demand on poor old Mother Nature.
And we're speaking on this International Day of Peace. To what extent do you think that overpopulation can be a threat to peace? Because I think you've seen in all your years in Africa the effects of overpopulation and war.
Yes, I certainly have. And of course, it's a mixture of the unsustainable lifestyle of many, and that includes the African elite. And then it's poverty, because if you're really poor, and so many people really are, then you have to cut down the last trees to desperately try and grow food or to make charcoal for sale to feed yourself and your family. So that, those two, as the population grows and as the Western world is moving in to take more and more of Africa's natural resources, and now particularly China, from Asia, it's creating situations where, for example, Gombe National Park, where I've done my study, used to be part of a belt of forests curling round from East Africa to the West Coast. And now it's a collection of patches of forests, increasingly fragmented, with the only really large area left in the Congo Basin.
And what effect has that had, by the way, on the chimpanzee population, where you made your name, an international reputation as a scientist?
The chimp numbers, as you started off by saying, have plummeted, and in part it's very definitely habitat destruction as people and cattle move into the forest, and the forest turns to woodland and then farmland, and then usually the soils are so poor that when they lose the tree cover, they become increasingly infertile and finally more or less useless for farming. And in addition to that, there is hunting. There's the bushmeat trade, there's the commercial hunting of wild animals for food, so very different from the old subsistence hunting where people used to shoot just enough to feed themselves. And on top of that, a brand new demand for chimpanzees in entertainment, so circuses and advertising and pets. And again, coming now particularly from China.
That is an extraordinary thing. I want to talk about that in a moment. But if I could just ask you to recall your experience, as I recall going back something like 50 years when you first went to Gombe, you experienced the nature of war, didn't you?
The war that we experienced was the genocide in Burundi, and there were refugees pouring past us along the lake in boats and some of them inland. We certainly saw the effect of war. And also, I did again when I was in the DRC, Democratic Republic of Congo, where the army rebelled and they were shooting outside the window. So there's a lot of disrest, and, you know, it's not helped by the fact that some of the African presidents became dictators. And basically, you know, one country gets good and peaceful, and then a new person comes to take over, as has happened in Tanzania, and things get ropey.
Did that have an influence, Jane, on your concern for peace as much as it did, of course, on animal welfare, seeing this on two occasions at close quarters?
Well, yes. I mean, I think the thing is that what I've come to realise more and more is the interconnectedness of everything. So when people are in conflict areas or when there's unrest within the country, you know, they can't really concentrate on preserving the environment. They're concentrating on preserving their lives. So that peace is part of a whole flourishing, healthy ecosystem. And a healthy ecosystem means an area where the wildlife and the environment can live in harmony with the people around it.
On the Religion and Ethics Report with Andrew West for this International Day of Peace, we're speaking with the internationally renowned scientist and conservationist, Jane Goodall. Jane, I recall reading that you yourself had witnessed brutality in the chimpanzee population. You were quite shocked by it. Forgive my naivety, but is it possible that that sort of brutality that you witnessed in the chimpanzee population is affected by the same environmental factors that produce human violence?
Certainly, to the extent that chimpanzees are highly territorial, and as their territories get encroached upon by human population growth, then of course you're going to see more interaction, brutal interactions between males of neighbouring communities because they get into contact with each other far more.
I want to ask, of course, now about the other major threat to the chimpanzee population, which, as we said, had fallen by 90%. I think in 1910 it was about 2 million. Today it's barely 200,000. And that is the use of chimpanzees for animal experimentation. I believe that recently you and Sir David Attenborough made a joint statement about the need to curb this experimentation on the chimpanzee population. How critical is this situation?
Well, it was very critical for chimpanzees, but fortunately, in almost all countries now, the use of chimpanzees per se has been discontinued, partly because it's very expensive, partly because of the protests of animal rights people, but partly because most of that experimentation today isn't providing useful results. So they are our closest relatives, but they are different. And so you can't always rely on some medical procedure that is beneficial for chimps being beneficial for humans. But the statement that David and I made is more about the other primates, the monkeys, particularly the poor old rhesus monkeys.
Yeah.
And they are still used, and this is what we were protesting, particularly their use in neurological experiments, which involve extreme physical restraint. So their heads are put in the vise and they can't move. And they're deprived of water and sleep. And it's extremely painful to watch secretly filmed video of these horrendous experiments.
And to what end are those experiments?
Well, they are saying that, that these primates neurological experiments have been beneficial in helping people to helping science to understand diseases like Alzheimer's, for example. And I'm not enough of a scientist in that realm to actually know how much primate research this kind has contributed. I just pray it has contributed something to, you know, for all the suffering that it's induced.
Well, extraordinary suffering. I think I read recently of scientists actually implanting the heads of rhesus monkeys on the bodies of other monkeys.
That was done, well, once it was done with a chimpanzee, actually. It was done in South Africa with a chimpanzee just once. It's horrendous.
And Jane, if the threat isn't necessarily that horrendous in the sense that you said that the chimpanzee experimentations have abated a little, you still point out, as you did earlier, the renewed threat for chimpanzees as domestic animals. How much of a threat is this, especially chimpanzees becoming pets in China?
Yes, well, that was the case for the US and Europe, and we sort of managed to prevent that by stricter laws about importation of chimpanzees and their use. They're still used in entertainment, but at least they can't be imported from Africa. But in China and to some extent the Middle East as well, this is where now there's a whole new demand. So we finish it off in one part of the world and it springs up in another. So these battles never end.
There are, of course, ongoing battles, in inverted commas, about the purpose of zoos. Now, I believe that you have very mixed emotions about the role of the zoo, because in many parts of the world, the animals are destroyed when they cease to become an attraction. Is there a place for the zoo?
It depends on the zoo. I mean, there literally are zoos and zoos and zoos. And they're really good zoos with ethical standards who do commit to looking after animals even when they're old. So it's not always clear that they follow these, but at least the conditions in which the animals are kept have improved hugely, and they're given enriched lives, and the keepers are now educated people, and they care deeply about the different animals that they're looking after. We have one wonderful woman, Hilda Trez, and she goes around the world to really difficult places, like really, really bad zoos in Egypt and parts of Asia and parts of Latin America. And I think she's very brave, very caring, and she's made enormous differences. So she can't wave a wand and create a large enclosure, but she certainly can and does improve what goes on within the enclosure, like giving them lots to do, challenging them, giving them more things to climb and so forth. Those could make a very big difference.
UN Peace Envoy and renowned scientist Dame Jane Goodall, ending today's edition of the Religion and Ethics Report, and thanks to the Jane Goodall Institute in Australia. You can hear a longer version of that interview on our homepage at the RN website. Go there, download and share. Thanks to producer Nadia Telgorley and technical producers Jolan Camilleri and Simon Branthwaite. I'm Andrew West. Back next week.